From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. The National Flood Insurance Program is set to expire on December 8th. That's tomorrow if you're listening to the live Thursday edition. The U.S. House of Representatives voted just last month to reauthorize the NFIP until 2022. Now the Senate must decide whether and how to move forward with the program. Congressman David Rauser, a Republican from North Carolina's 7th District, voted in support of the 21st Century Flood Reform Act. Fellow Republican Walter Jones from the neighboring district voted against it, along with a majority of Democrats. Despite the divide, reforming the NFIP is a priority for both parties. The program is debt-ridden after a series of major storms going back as far as Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Some say privatizing flood insurance is the way to go. Others suggest it's more important to accurately assess flood risk. With us today are two experts to discuss North Carolina's flood mapping process and what the region is doing to prepare for these major storms. Spencer Rogers is a coastal engineer and geologist with North Carolina Sea Grant, which is headquartered at NC State. Spencer Rogers is housed at UNCW and has an adjunct position within NC State's Civil Engineering Department. Spencer Rogers, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for the invitation.
Also joining us today is Greg Rudolph, Shore Protection Manager with Carteret County since 2001. He's better known as Rudy, and that's how we shall refer to him today. Rudy, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We are, of course, inviting you to join the conversation if you have a question for either of our experts about flooding in southeastern North Carolina. We'd like to hear from you. You can reach us on this live Thursday edition by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Scientists and the National Flood Insurance Program assess risk based partly on this 100-year flood idea. And you guys have this sort of, you've called it, arbitrary. Can you kind of explain what the 100-year flood risk is, what it means? As a homeowner, we know that when people buy properties and a real estate agent says it's in the 100-year floodplain, a lot of people will think, oh, well, I'm golden because I probably won't be in this house for 100 years. Spencer Rogers.
When the National Flood Insurance Program was put together, it was the first attempt to regulate building construction anywhere in the coast. And the way they did that was to use flood insurance coverage as the carrot in order to get local communities to adopt construction standards. And to have the construction standard, they had to pick a number. And in many of our building codes, there are return periods or an annual risk that's used to establish that that standard. In this case, they chose the 100-year flood, which is saying on average you will get a storm of this water level once in every 100 years. And the other way to look at it is in any given year, there's a 1% chance of that storm or worse. That sounds like pretty good odds.
It does.
Yeah. The problem is that risk accumulates over time, and with the wonders of the statistics, that it's not linear. So if you look at how it accumulates from different uses, say a 30-year mortgage, there's a 26% chance of exceeding that flood within a mortgage life. I think a more useful, since we're regulating buildings, is to look at it in terms of the average lifetime of a building. And for wood frame construction, that's about 70 years. So the 100-year risk of a 70-year house is about 50%. So the chance of your house exceeding that standard is like flipping coins, heads or tails, 50-50 chance.
So let me make sure that I have this right. You're saying a house that is in a 100-year floodplain risk has a 50-50 chance of being flooded over the course of 70 years?
That's correct. If we do everything right.
That doesn't sound like
like it's labeled on its face. Do you know what I mean? I mean, that seems misleading if there's a potential buyer looking at a property.
That was an initial choice for the flood program that was adopted nationally. But if you look at in building codes and other risks, that, for instance, our wind risk now, including the safety factors that are normal in the design for structural wind design, is a 700-year wind speed unless you are a critical facility like a hospital, and then it's a 1,400-year wind speed for earthquake design.
What is a 700-year wind speed? What does that even mean?
Same,
like maximum winds likely to occur over the course of 700
once
years.
Once in 700 years.
Except with your math, it's different. So what's the real number?
Well, that's the safety factor that's installed in wind design that is a routine in most engineering, that you don't design something to fall apart at a specific flood or wind speed. You design it to be safe at that level.
So what kind of wind speed are we talking about? What would that maximum wind speed be in that 700-year?
That's on the 140, 130 miles per hour along our coastline here.
Okay, that doesn't sound like a lot when we think of wind speeds that are parts of hurricanes.
We think of what we're told and what we think were the wind speeds, but not what they were actually measured. So we have had very few wind speeds on the East Coast that have gotten into the 140 to 150 mile per hour range. Those are very rare events on the East Coast.
Okay. Now, you're saying for critical care facilities, for a hospital, they would need to plan for a 1,400-year maximum wind speed. For a fire, I think you told our producer it was roughly 3,000 years. That sounds to me like pretty good odds. But you say the Dutch build their coastal structures to 10,000-year standards, so that makes our standards what?
Yeah, for coastal structures and flood control structures, for instance, that the Dutch and the Japanese use a 10,000-year event, and for some internal areas for flooding, they use 200 to 2,000-year flood events. So the point of that is that what sounds like a high standard at the 100-year flood and a 1% really is not a high standard. It's a relatively low standard that arguably in the lifetime of what we're building is likely to occur. So the thing to do and to keep in mind when using that number is that it's important to add safety factors, which in many cases for flood is just higher elevations. You don't build at the minimum elevation. You add a foot or two, and you significantly increase the return period that building can survive.
Greg Rudolph, Carteret County Shore Protection Manager. Understanding you're a coastal guy, that's your area of expertise. Can you just help us a little bit with Hurricane Matthew? Because this was a surprise for a lot of people. It blew through October of 2016, I believe. Mm-hmm. And we think of hurricanes as coastal events, but this flooded out inland counties. What does that have to do with our floodplain mapping system? And was that a failure, or what failed here? Why were people surprised?
Yeah, and I think that's over the course of the past several years with these mega storms, Harvey, Matthew. There's sort of the mapping the risk, and then there's the insurance that goes along with that. So if you're not mapping the risk properly, then the insurance isn't going to be sound. So. And it gets complicated because this FEMA reauthorization is trying to tackle both, and it gets complicated, and we're going to wind up having a much scaled down version. There's all sorts of ideas about privatizing the market and stuff like that, and I can almost, without being a politician, I can almost guarantee that some of that stuff is just not going to happen. They're just going to reauthorize it, and it's going to be generally status quo. But to answer your question, so there's, if you go upland, There's you know, river flooding is more of the flood hazard, where compared to the immediate coast on our sounds and oceans, it's more of the storm hazard, the wind blowing the water into the creeks, the storm surge of the waves coming in. So how we map that is a different, and even the risk that's associated with that. I'm sure we're going to talk about all these different zones, the A zone and the V zones. Well, some of these zones don't even exist pretty much in the inland areas, but they do exist here on the coast because we have those unique variables of waves.
What does that mean? What is an A zone?
Okay, well.
What are the zones?
Yeah, sure. Well, basically there's A zone, V zone, shaded X, and X. So
there are four zones.
There's four zones. The insurance mandate, if you have a mortgage that is a federally insured, and if it's in within the 100-year floodplain, it's mandated to have insurance. That is basically inside the A zone. If the waves are above 3 feet in that A zone, you're now in the V zone, basically. Okay, so there's a gigantic zone, A zone, and if the waves are over 3 feet, you're in the V zone, and that's obviously more of an insurance premiums and things of that nature. Shaded X is between the 100-year and the 500-year level, and unshaded X is above 500 years.
Okay, so X and shaded X and unshaded X
is outside.
Okay, outside the floodplain, so those people would not normally be concerned about getting flood insurance.
Correct, except when, go back to your point, except on a Hurricane Matthew or Hurricane Harvey, when they show all the pictures of things being flooded,
yeah.
A lot of that is outside, is in the X zone, which in theory is outside of the floodplain. But of course, you'll go and you see those pictures, and they're outside the floodplain, but you point to the National Flood Insurance Program as being broken, but they aren't mapped in that zone. So,
and when we come back, I'm going to ask you more about why this flood insurance program is so troubled and debt-ridden. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM, taking a closer look at flood risk. And we'll explore in a little while what North Carolina is doing right. We're taking your questions on this live Thursday discussion. Have you been surprised by flooding in your local community? Tell us about it. You can call us today at 910-343-1138. You can email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. The United States Senate will consider December 8th whether to reauthorize the National Flood Insurance Program. Two coastal experts are with us today exploring some of the complications, some of the many complications that exist in that program. And we'll talk about how North Carolina communities can better plan for some of these natural disasters. With us to answer your questions on this Thursday, Greg Rudolph, also known as Rudy, Shore Protection Manager for Carteret County. And we have Spencer Rogers, Coastal Engineer and Geologist with North Carolina Sea Grant out of NC State. And they're taking your questions on this Thursday. You can get your question in one of two ways, 910-343-1138, or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Rudy, just before we went to break, you were explaining the four different zones that establish whether and how much somebody is in a floodplain. And then you said most of the people probably who were flooded out by Hurricane Matthew in 2016 were not in a floodplain.
I would have to look that up, but that's generally the case. I know in Hurricane Sandy, for instance, I think 60 to 80% of the damages were outside of the floodplain.
Now
and think about that; those people aren't insured.
And so then what happens? So the disaster occurs. Uh-huh. They assess the damage. Who pays for it?
Well, that's been. I'm kind of. I don't mean to laugh, but if the National Flood Insurance Program has paid for any of those homes outside of the floodplain, that's not fair, because then you have people who are putting into the pool and it's going outside of the pool. But a lot of times the federal government will pass emergency appropriations to go into those areas and make those people whole that are outside the floodplain. But it's not a linear process like it is if you're in the floodplain, you make a claim, et cetera, et cetera.
And the
Sandy was $10 billion in flood claims, but it was hundreds of millions in dollars in disaster relief funding. And at least if you have flood insurance, you've been paying in advance to offset those losses, where those that don't get flood insurance, a lot of that support is coming directly out of disaster relief, which is still coming out of the federal budget, just not the same bucket as the flood insurance program.
Now, I think you've been leading up to part of why the program is debt-ridden, but I understand that the debt really started, it started going kerflooey in 2005 after Hurricane Katrina. Can you kind of give us the history there, why this wasn't properly funded? Spencer Rogers.
It's arguably whether it's properly funded or not, I think, at this point, but it certainly has its issues. And Katrina alone was about a $17 billion loss, and Sandy added another $10 billion. The storms this year may be even worse. But if you look at the history before that, it was basically paying for itself. The flood insurance program was paying for itself.
Before Katrina.
Before Katrina. And I think if you look at it now in hindsight of those storm events, there are lots of ways that it's not a pure insurance program. It was developed for construction management and requiring higher buildings at the federal level. But it included in the cost of the insurance program all of the mapping cost for the entire nation. Insurance companies don't do mapping like that, that are very expensive mapping operations. So there are also premiums that when the federal flood insurance was not selling well and many people weren't getting it, they authorized private insurance companies to put their letterhead on the federal policy and collect the premiums when they were also collecting your homeowner's premiums. So that allowed the federal policy a broader coverage of sales.
How much of those premiums did the private companies get to keep?
Almost a third. And there is some work necessary to initially rate the building, looking at the elevation certificates and getting the right premiums charged. But after the first year, basically they're sending a bill every year as their only expense. So for a third of the premium every single year, the private companies are collecting that, and that doesn't go into the pool that offset the losses. I think if you looked at the total program cost without losing that one-third to the private companies, it would more than cover the losses in Katrina, Sandy, and probably this year in Harvey and the other storms this year.
So, sorry, you may have already explained this, but the private companies were collecting the premiums. They were keeping a third of those premiums. But when it came to paying out claims or making people whole who did not have flood insurance, that was entirely on the federal government, on the NFIP.
Correct. And further, when a claim was investigated, the private company was paid additionally to assess the claim and send the check. But it all came out of the federal flood insurance budget.
And that was working, ostensibly, until 2005.
Correct.
And then Katrina was so catastrophic, that's what turned it.
It was the highest storm surge on record, 28 feet above sea level in parts of Mississippi.
Rudy, with Shore Protection Manager for Carteret County, what would be the problem with just privatizing this whole thing? Wouldn't the laws of economics work out the proper premium amount and put this back in the black?
Yeah, well, and I was going to add to Spencer's conversation too. Your maximum a settlement is $250,000 per a structure. So you see a lot of things that. I'll make up a number. X County has $28 billion worth of property. Well, all that property is not insured because the max is $250,000. So, again, that kind of complicates exactly what insurance companies, there are about 80 of them, I think, that are kind of a part of that pool. So what they collect versus what's paid out. But anyway, so that's another thing to kind of keep in mind.
Yeah.
Some private insurance has always been available, particularly for add-on above the $250,000 limit. So the flood insurance picks up the highest risk of the early damage, and anything excess you can cover through Lloyd's of London if you don't want to go somewhere else. But there have also been standard flood policies from time to time that were offered in areas where federal flood insurance was not available. For instance, the Cobra areas on North Topsail and other communities, federal flood insurance is not today available.
Why is that?
It was prohibited by Congress in order to, in theory, discourage unwise development in undeveloped areas. Those developed areas have often densely developed, even with that limit. But occasionally, private insurance was available in those areas.
You're talking about North Topsail as an example.
As an example. And there are many others in the state.
Yeah. And so when I think of North Topsail, I think of very expensive beachfront homes falling into the ocean. Am I imagining the right part of Topsail?
There are a few, but more broadly, that there are not that many buildings falling in the ocean other than near the inlet in North Topsail.
Okay. And that's all very expensive property and generally expensive homes?
Way above $250,000 in most cases for the buildings.
Could there be an so federal flood insurance then is not available for that particular part of North
Correct.
Carolina?
But I think the important issue is to understand how the insurance companies perceive it and whether they're likely to get involved in the business or not. Insurance companies really like investments in risk that are very flat and level. Two examples would be life insurance and car insurance, that you've got X number of people dying every year for various reasons and X number of car crashes every year. It's a very flat number from year to year if you look at a big area, like particularly the nation, but even down to the state level, it's very flat. What they don't like is something that has very spiky losses. So if they start to charge premiums for flood insurance, and next year is a disaster, they lose their shirt. They're bankrupt.
So what you're saying is there's not really an incentive for private insurers to cover, say, that part of North Topsail that federal flood insurance doesn't cover.
I'd say there are incentives if the rates get high enough, but because of this risky, uncertain future next year compared to the next 100 years, they don't like those types of risks. So they generally don't get involved in those markets unless there's a lot of money to be made to cover the risk if it happens this year.
Is Rudy?
Yeah, and the thing that we're this whole conversation of the private industry getting back into the National Flood Insurance Program is coming up in this reauthorization bill.
Yes.
But it's kind of has to be an all or nothing, because the private industry just wants to ensure the lowest risk inside of the floodplain. But that would be horrible for the National Flood Insurance Program, because they would only be taking care of the most riskiest places. Meanwhile, the private industry would be taking care of the less risky places. So I think that kind of proposal is, like I said, at the end of the day, I think you won't see that in the final bill.
And where does the idea of different socioeconomic classes, how does that play into this? I mean, could you make an argument for people who are building in riskier areas who are probably wealthy? I mean, is it usually true that people who are willing to build in beachfront areas that are higher risk for these sorts of disasters should be taking on more of the risk themselves and paying more for their own insurance, Rudy?
Well, this gets more, you know, wonky if we haven't gone there enough. But because the building standards are so high on the ocean front, that most risky V zone,
yes,
even in the floodplain, over the course of the history, the V zone has actually paid for itself. Believe it or not. So if you think about that, if you just look at that, it actually paid for itself.
That's a very common misconception, but if you look at the annual premium collections, the V-zone is subsidizing the rest of the area. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't problems with the
right
way those premiums are set up,
sure,
but the simple supporting rich folks on the beachfront, subsidizing them, that's not really the way the statistics indicate from their claims damage and their collection rates.
And why is that?
Premiums are a lot higher.
Mm-hmm.
10 times higher in some cases.
And I think where you get into that kind of socioeconomic problem is now that the National Flood Insurance Program is quote unquote broke and the rates go up each year. When you remap zones, a lot of the folks living in the lowland, I'll call them swampy areas, mm-hmm, are probably more the economically disenfranchised folks that maybe their mortgage is, you know, $100,000 or whatnot. I'll make up a number, $700 a month. Well, now they're going to have a flood insurance, something new, you know, a new flood insurance possessed on their property. And now that could be $200 or $300 extra.
Now,
and, you know, see, now that's where you don't hear a lot of discussion going towards the folks that are in the economically depressed areas that are going to have to pay these higher, you know, premiums because of this.
And those people, so you mentioned this could be a swampy lowland area. That's where it's more likely to be.
Yeah. But generally, I'm just thinking of kind of some of the economically distressed areas.
Right. Now, what happens if, say, somebody is in one of these economically distressed areas, the flood insurance program changes, and they can't afford an increased premium? What then?
That's a good question. I mean, what do they do? I mean, because a mortgage company is going to require that they have the flood insurance, and if now their collective mortgage payment is above what they can afford, you know, I don't know what happens. Do they not pay it? Do they, you know?
That's why Congress needs to be very careful on how they modify the flood insurance program. Mm-hmm. Congress has attempted at least twice before since 2012 to make changes that were well-intended, but when they got into implementation, they found out there were some really serious problems in the way it was going to affect low-income people and various other groups. We saw some premiums go over $50,000 a year for $250,000 in coverage, which is nuts. I mean, nobody in their right mind would pay that, and the private insurance companies would love it because they can charge a lot less than that and make a lot of money. But because the insurance was required for the mortgage, they had to pay, would have had to pay $50,000 a year for that coverage. So in the amendments they're looking at now, there are various things on the table. They need to be very careful to look at the comprehensive long-term impacts of changes that they think. Some of the simple solutions, it turns out, aren't really going to be very good solutions if you look at it in terms of the long run.
Go ahead, Rudy.
And also there's, you know, real estate implications. So if you're in an older district or town and you're in a floodplain, but that house has been in your family for a couple, you know, generations or whatever, and it's paid for, you don't have a mortgage associated with it. But then you go to sell it, you have a huge premium, and a house that looks attractive to buy won't be attractive because the flood insurance is just makes it impossible.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about potential changes to the National Flood Insurance Program, which expires December 8th. That's tomorrow if you're listening to the live Thursday edition, talking about why it's so complicated to get it right. With us to answer your questions, Greg Rudolph, Shore Protection Manager for Carteret County. We also have Spencer Rogers, Coastal Engineer and Geologist with North Carolina Sea Grant out of NC State. You can ask your own question during this live Thursday show by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. When we're considering flood mapping, are we also talking about the impact of climate change on sea level rise? And will the flood maps change? You're both kind of snickering right now. Will the flood maps change as the oceans rise?
That's a common urban legend, actually, that never seems to go away. As members of the Sea Level Rise panel for the state, we were intimately involved in writing some of the reports. So we appreciate sea level rise issues.
And that sea level rise panel was shut down by the...
No, we weren't shut down. We did our job and published the reports and have updated it. We were required by the legislature to update it 5 years later, and we have done that, too.
Right.
But the bottom line for the flood insurance program is very, very clear. It has always been and continues to be at this time against federal policy to consider any sea level rise in a flood insurance map. It cannot be done legally, and it's subject to appeal if somebody attempted to do that. Now, and that has not changed, even though it comes up all the time. Interestingly enough, in one of Congress's last amendments, they required FEMA to consider adding sea level rise. And they have done that, and the panel recommended that they do it. But FEMA has not done it, and it doesn't exist in any flood map that's ever been drawn in the United States so far.
Should it?
Arguably, it probably needs to be considered to some extent, but the bigger problem is not a little bit of sea level rise over the next few years. By use of the 100-year event, we're still a couple feet below the safety factors that we ought to be implementing at the local level. So the biggest problem today and for the next 10 years is definitely not sea level rise. It's our low standards.
And Spencer Rogers, I think you've also said that if the right data was put into the programs that create the flood maps, we would only need to do flood mapping once. There wouldn't need to be updates. Is that accurate?
Well, I mean, yeah, modeling has been gradually improving over the years, and we are definitely still making modeling improvements. But if we ever get it right, then we certainly won't have to do it as frequently. But if we are living with sea level over decades of time, that's certainly going to have an effect on the 100-year flood prediction. But the bigger problem now is the low 100-year standard, not what may occur in the next decade or between the next two flood maps.
Right. Go ahead, Greg Rudolph.
And it becomes complicated because you're so worried about next year's flood insurance bill. So planning for sea level rise even 10 years into the future, there's just a disconnect with, again, the mapping and what's you know, the risk versus the insurance, the implementation of the insurance into those maps. So I think that a group, the Technical Mapping Advisory Council, was a group formed by the legislation. They're trying to figure out how to make that sea level rise quotient work.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a conversation about flood mapping and the National Flood Insurance Program, which is set to expire on December 8th. After this break, you'll have one more segment to call in and ask your own question of our coastal experts. The number during the live Thursday show is 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're learning today about some of the problems dogging the National Flood Insurance Program, what local communities can do to plan for catastrophic natural disasters, and we're taking your questions. With us today, Spencer Rogers, a coastal engineer and geologist with North Carolina Sea Grant, headquartered at NC State. We also have Greg Rudolph, the shore protection manager for Carteret County. There are two ways to get your question in during this live Thursday edition. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. And just a reminder, it's the last segment, so you only have a few minutes left to get your question in. There is a divergence between the North Carolina floodplain mapping and the FEMA mapping. Is there not, Spencer Rogers?
Very definitely. After Hurricane Floyd, where we had similar flooding in isolated spots compared to Matthew, that the story goes that the governor was looking at some of the flood-damaged areas and turned around and asked, well, why are these people getting wet? And the response was, well, they got bad flood maps. He turned around and said, go fix it. That started a process that was eligible at the community level to take over their own flood mapping at the community. North Carolina walked to FEMA and said, we want to do the entire state. So rather than get one map replaced every year for the next century to do every 100 counties in the state.
One map meaning one map per county.
One county at a time. They were looking at 100 years of replacing all the flood maps. The state said, we want to do it in 3 years. And they did it actually in seven. They took all 100 counties. They did a major advance in surveying the ground elevations, which are critical to understand when you're modeling flooding, for the entire state. So they went from an accuracy of 10 to 20 feet of ground elevation to about a foot and a half initially. And since The studies have been done. They're now down to a couple inches in ground elevation for the entire state, which is unheard of in the country. And once they got the first full replacement of the 100 counties done, they went back to the coast and realized that their storm surge modeling was way out of date, and it was needed to do that. And they're now in the process of redoing the more or less the 20 coastal counties with a new storm surge model for hurricane and northeast storm frequencies.
And why the new storm surge model?
The old model that was used back in the 80s actually won't run on a computer anymore. So what they did in the first go-around was reuse the old numbers from that model, but recognize that there were much better models out today. And the one that's used by the Corps of Engineers and by the FEMA now is called ADCERC. And it just models individual storm events much more accurately, particularly in the sounds and bays, than any of the old models ever did.
Astrid Caldas, I hope I'm pronouncing that name properly. You guys probably know of this scientist. She's a senior climate scientist with climate and energy at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And Caldas says the research projected by Wilmington will go from experiencing a few tidal floods a year to as many as 150 by the year 2035. By the year 2045, the number of floods may be in excess of 350. Why is the frequency of these floods increasing, Rudy? Carteret County.
Well, if I had the real answer for that, I probably wouldn't be behind this microphone. obviously, issues such as the sea level rise are, you know, contributing to that, but also just the more extreme weather events are also complicating that as well. So that's Spencer actually had a long discussion about some research about this. So, that's basically why. But again, a lot of that flooding is already happening in the floodplain. That's already the construction should be okay-ish for that, because again, if it's in the floodplain, you're building up to the
building
proper
regulations.
Standards. Yeah, but still, though, that's where that nuanced flooding word that comes in. It's not damage a construction damage. It's a nuance. So
he's really referring to nuisance flooding, which is not the one that knocks down your house.
Right.
Maybe the lowest level houses will get wet, but what's more likely to get flooded is your street. Mm-hmm. So Water Street was named that for a good reason here in Wilmington.
and it regularly floods.
We know with sea level rise and this increasing frequency of nuisance flooding, we are likely to get far more nuisance flood days in the future than we are now. And it's a significant issue, but it's pretty different than designing for those top-end extreme events. We're going to have to deal with both of them, but we may have a better chance to deal with the nuisance flooding because it's so much lower than the extreme event issues that are dependent on the 100-year design, which the nuisance flooding is not.
Moody's Investor Services, which one of the largest credit rating agencies in the world, announced recently that it was going to penalize communities for failing to plan for sea level rise due to climate change. Is Carteret County, Rudy, planning for sea level rise? And if you are, how do you do that?
It's sometimes you're planning for it, but you may not be calling it because of that issue. So, for instance, The FEMA has a program called a community rating system. So if you do things above the baseline standard, you get points, and those points lower your flood insurance rate. So if the elevation of your structure has to be 8 feet above sea level, community may say, no, we're going to make it 2 more feet than that. So are we combating sea level rise? Well, yes, but it's because of other incentives. My world is beach, nourishment and stuff like that. Well, we are combating sea level by doing beach, nourishment, just like the Dutch do, but it's not under the total guise of a sea level rise. So again, that becomes a complicated answer but yes, I mean, we are doing things.
We had a question from Carol out of Wilmington. She says, my house has been paid for. I've lived here for over 30 years. My neighbors did have to get it. I think she means flood insurance. What do I need to expect if I continue to stay here or sell the house concerning flood insurance? Don't currently have it.
Well, the risk varies throughout the community. So the first thing to do is look at NC Flood Mapping's maps. And they're both existing maps that are in effect now that set the rates today. But preliminary maps are proposed, which have some big changes in some areas that she needs to pay attention to see what it's going to do to future rates.
And the proposed maps, are you happy with those, Spencer Rogers?
No. Well, mapping is a real challenge. It involves a whole series of complicated models. And I think the most important thing to know about modeling is all models are wrong. Some are useful. So just because it's a model doesn't mean it's right, and it doesn't mean it's wrong. But we need to put in perspective where it's working and where it's not. And some of our most important models, like the storm surge model and ADSERC, is working very well. But for better or worse, FEMA limits the models that can be used for flood mapping. And many of FEMA's upper-level models for wave heights, wave run-up, erosion, all of those are antiquated, some over 40 years old.
So assuming that the Senate reauthorizes this National Flood Insurance Program, and considering that these inland counties were flooded by surprise, I mean, a lot of people did not predict that Hurricane Matthew and Hurricane Harvey were going to cause the devastation that it did, understanding that's inland, which is a different issue from the coastal issue. But still, should I just get flood insurance if I own property, no matter where I am? And can I get it if I'm not in one of those zones that requires it?
Yes, it's called the preferred risk policy. And that's obviously a lower rate, but you get the same insurance costs. So if you're above the 100-year floodplain, even and within the 100 to 500-year floodplain, shaded X, some mortgage companies will actually require that you get the flood insurance anyhow if you're like right on the edge. So and that's brings us to a general issue. If we're having more extreme events that are flooding above the 100-year floodplain, a lot of people wouldn't trust the federal government, but maybe you need to have the shaded X contributing towards the national flood insurance program. So when you do have these catastrophic events, everyone's covered, and maybe the building codes are better on the newer houses and things of that nature.
Any owner or buyer needs to investigate the ground elevation around their area to see if the ground is going to get wet, and then look at the floor elevation above that to see what the risk is. And just because you're out of the 100-year floodplain or higher than the elevation does not mean you're safe. You've, at the minimum level, you've got a 50-50 chance of getting flooded by your house. So if you're close to the floodplain or close to the flood elevation, it's a really, really good idea to have flood insurance coverage. And in preferred risk policies, it's pretty cheap. The maximum coverage is available for about $400, $450 a year, which is bargain rates for a lot of safety.
We had a call from, sorry, did you want to?
Yeah, I'll say that's a $400 versus $4,000.
Right.
It sounds
like a bargain in comparison. Linda from Carolina Beach asks, what costs do the premiums include? Are there additional state or federal costs?
All of the premiums are federally regulated nationwide, even though it may have a private name on the private company name on the policy. So there is no state or local issue in looking at the cost of insurance. From town to town, it'll be identical for the same level of zone and risk.
Chris asks, would current homeowners with subsidized flood insurance be grandfathered in with their policies?
That depends on Congress, and that's using double terminology. When the flood insurance program was invented, they agreed to cover all of the older buildings at very low elevations or whatever elevation
that did
they were.
Not meet current standards.
Right. Now, maybe they did, but if they were old, they were subsidized.
Right.
So they had a guaranteed rate at a low level. that got the existing owners willing to adopt construction standards for all the new buildings. And the new maps were identified to say you had to build this high for anything that came later. And they had actuarial rates at the time. But our modeling and methods have gained in accuracy. And those that were regulated and told to build at a certain height are called subsidized. They are post-firm and they are not subsidized, but they built to the standard at the time. As the standards change, they may not fit the new standards, but there have been some attempts in the previous amendments to remove the grandfathering clauses. And that's caused havoc on buildings that were legally constructed by the owners at the time of construction, as best we could tell them. Yet they were getting very large premium increases when the grandfathering clauses were removed. And that's probably a bad thing. All the building codes have grandfather clauses routinely to take care of older building construction. So removing the grandfather clause is probably a very bad idea within the floodplain. That's different than subsidized, though, because there's some very low elevation buildings that are very high risk that the subsidies were expected to be removed sooner or later. It's just when you choose to do that.
Rudy.
I would say a terminology issue here. You always hear pre-firm, and pre-firm is what is that first example South Bencher was talking about. Before the flood maps were adopted, before your community participated in the National Flood Insurance Program, the homes that were below the floodplain, if you will, they got grandfathered in. So you hear a lot about pre-firm and taking away subsidized rate. So.
Now, this may be unrealistic. We hear about when it comes to beachfront homes, for instance, people talk about retreat, and there are a few beach communities that have been called progressive where people have done that. But what about changing where people can build? Is that something that needs to be looked at, Spencer Rogers? Are people building in places where they shouldn't be right now? And
in some cases, but we're doing a much better job than most other states. We have a setback based on the erosion rate in the area of at least 30 times the erosion rate. And remember, we were complaining about a 100-year flood standard. So our erosion standard is actually lower than our flood standard, one of the few standards worse than flooding. But there's some safety factors built into that that aren't obvious. We use a minimum erosion rate of 2 feet, and your actual erosion rate on average in the state is less than 1 foot per year. So we're probably up with safety factors at least a 60-year, and the owner has a choice of building farther landward should they see fit. So like flood standards, building farther away from the coast is often a very good idea when you're building a new house.
Now, we know that people can find out when they're looking at a property and deciding whether to buy it what the current rating is, whether it's in a floodplain. Mm. Which one of those four zones it happens to be, but can they find out if that property has flooded before? Can you find out the history of a property the way you can look up the VIN number of a car and find out the history of that?
Not easily, other than ask the neighbors. For privacy reasons, flood insurance claims are treated like your tax forms. So they're not publicly available. One of the few things that you can do is look up areas that have been repetitive flood losses or severe repetitive losses. And each community is given a list of those that you can go to the town hall and find out if that address is on the list.
So maybe people need to do a little more research before they
definitely
purchase property. That's this edition of Coastline. Greg Rudolph, Spencer Rogers, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for the invitation.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Associate producer is Rachel Keith. Production assistant is Caitlin Hanrahan. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast. You can find it on the WHQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. Join us for Coastline live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 and 98.9 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. For Coastline.